You're listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between at horticulture.com. This is Jason Horsley. After a brief sojourn in which I was waiting to see what sort of new direction this podcast would take. And this is it. This is my first conversation post my return from England and Finland. This is edited conversation. There were quite a few technical problems with the connection, sound and whatnot, which required a lot of editing to smooth that out, but also I cut the conversation down in order to condense the coherence, make it more coherent. You can find some of the edited parts in an outtakes MP3 where you listen to this two-part conversation. And the new intro and outro songs are from a local artist, Jeff Berner, who's based in Vancouver, an independent artist who I heard about via a customer in the thrift store. Sure where we're going to start, but that's fairly normal. But what's not so normal is that I've been out of the podcasting loop for a while. That was pretty organic. I mean, there weren't opportunities arising, but also I wasn't looking for them. Like, I felt like I needed to take a break because I wasn't really sure. I'm not really sure what direction I want to take the podcast in, and even my writing's appears to have continued unchanged, but that's only because I had a series already written, and so now I'm just churning it out, and actually that'll be the end of that tomorrow. And I just read your notes yesterday. Suffice it to say, it was a life of high strainness. I mean, the last few years for you have been years of what is known in the UFO field as high strangeness, if it still is, but it used to be called that. I'll tell you what stands out for me as a place to start, because I think it's relevant from various different angles, and that's your Kundalini rising experience, and that's right at the start of your notes. So let's just start there, because you didn't write much about it. You wrote about the circumstances that led to it, but you didn't describe very much about the experience itself. So what did you experience that you described as Kundalini rising, and why did you choose to describe it that way?
Great question. Well, I was at the time, just to start with the basic facts from a sort of phenomenological perspective and then add a little bit of dimension by characterizing why I called it that. At the time, I remember I was sitting in a bathroom at a house that I rented at the time, and I won't name the city in case we get into some of the other topics that I'm a little less comfortable locating in a geographical context, but at the place I was living at the time, there was a bathroom, and I was, you know, doing some showering and self-care and that sort of thing, and I was listening to the Game of Thrones soundtrack, and I remember sitting on the toilet seat, you know, maybe pausing for a minute, listening to the music, and I felt a very unusual, you know, something I'd never felt at the time, like it all gets very subjective, but basically an energy rising sensation from the base of my spine, and then almost like the top of my head opened up. I didn't actually have that impression, but that's the closest description that I can give to it. And the music suddenly took on this very personal feeling, kind of, I do think the Game of Thrones music in general is pretty evocative and pretty well done. And I'd been a fan of the show at the time for a while. So had a lot of associations with it, and there was a bit of grandiosity right from the start with the experience, you know. And it was really just a very emotionally overwhelming experience. And this is a term that I heard later, you know, the kind of in the, I don't really consider it to be like a, you know, UFO or necessarily a contact experience, but the term download does sort of seem to apply, just because it was like a, almost like a switch was flipped, or like a lot of different aspects of my paradigm changed all at once. And you know, it's like I remember after that I would walk through the house, and it was like I would look at things that I would normally never look at. And at the time, I wasn't the most mindful person, you know. I didn't really have like a goal to be mindful or particularly in the moment or anything, but prior to that point. But it was like I would go through my house and I would look at maybe a vase or something that I hadn't really looked at for months, and just kind of consider it. So it just seemed like, you know, totally non-volitionally and out of the blue, all of a sudden I was looking at things in a different way. And I started really just thinking deeply at that time about really every aspect of my life, and particularly what was in front of me, kind of recapitulating things that, you know, that we normally kind of take for granted. In fact, I think that it's necessary to take things for granted just to get through the day. You know, if you're trying to get certain things done, you can't speculate, well, you know, where did that vase come from, and why is it that color, and why did I choose it? And it was not totally debilitating, but I do remember very early on that I told my girlfriend at the time that it was scary. It was really unexpected. And I'd done like 7 or 8 years before that, I had done some yoga. And so I was vaguely familiar with terms like Kundalini and, you know, chakras and things like that. But I was pretty, a lot of the work that I was doing at the time was like science writing, and I was in a pretty rigid, I think kind of, now I think of it as silly, kind of scientific materialist. It was really kind of an unquestioned scientific materialist paradigm. It wasn't like I chose that as the best philosophy, but I was really into like biochemistry and sort of mechanistic explanations for consciousness. And, you know, again, in a pretty unconsidered way, but I immediately knew that, you know, I could either kind of explain it as like a manic episode or something like that. And I didn't discount that, and I still don't. I think there might still be some validity to that as a one way of looking at it, but I guess that's not mutually exclusive with something like a Kundalini rising experience. And so I started to look up, I mean, this, I'm jumping ahead here, because once I was pretty well out of that experience, I started looking up what is a classic Kundalini rising experience. And so many of the things that I had experienced, like including the way that it was fairly temporary and, you know, sudden onset, relatively temporary, and other things that don't come to mind right now that I had in common with that. So I like that term just because it does have more of a spiritual dimension, and a lot of the external factors, like you talked about, the high strangeness, other things that changed in my life at that time, aren't accounted for by the strictly psychiatric explanation.
Well, they wouldn't necessarily be accounted for by Kundalini rising either, though, would they? Because it was like what you described was your things in your environment, and not necessarily mystical things either, like all kinds of dark criminal activity and things of that nature, right? So just pointing that out, that wouldn't necessarily expect a Kundalini rising to lead to enmeshment with underground criminal organizations. Not saying that that actually happened to you, but you got the sense that possibly that was going on around you, right? I suppose right. You could say that you were able to see something that you weren't able to see previously. Is that how you interpret it?
Good question. I think that, well, you know, there's that whole I'm not sure how you feel about Robert Anton Wilson, really. I know I've heard you talk about him before. It seems like you used to be more of almost an adherent, and maybe not so much now. But I think that his maybe logic is pretty useful here, because I really don't know. I think it's healthier to just say maybe to either one.
Yeah, well, that's
And,
liminalism.
right.
I
And
mean,
I
not
definitely.
only, but yeah.
I definitely don't insist on knowing or on having a particular explanation for it. I think that, I mean, now to revisit whether Kundalini rising would account for that or not, if it's even, I mean, what does that even mean, really? I've heard some other people talk about, I can't think of the person's name right now. Maybe I can send it to you, and if this turns out to be a show, we can put it in the show notes. But I've heard a couple of interviews of people since then. And again, I wasn't steeped in this lore at the time or anything like that. So what's always interesting to me is to find someone else where the pattern fits that I didn't know about, there being a pattern at the time. I if anything, at the time, I did kind of think I was more losing mental stability, and that's one of the things that was so scary about it, was that I was stuck in that more biochemical explanation of like, oh, it's too much dopamine, it's this, it's that, nothing good. But I would say that, well, if you use more of an idealist kind of platonic lens of everything is mind, then I think that could account for why things would appear to be strange inside and outside of the mind at the same time. I'm pretty comfortable playing with that lens now.
I'm not too comfortable with it, although I don't mind, talking about it, but I don't. I think anyway, but I don't want to get stuck on too much abstract and philosophical. I want to bring it back to the Kundalini rising as a descriptor, because I don't think that you've answered the question yet. As in, like, to me, Kundalini rising, well, it describes an energy coming up the spine and all the way out the crown of the head, and that's the, as you said, opening all the chakras. We didn't quite say that, but so then that suggests to me a sensational experience, one that's in sensation as well as everywhere else. So, did you have any of those elements to the experience?
I did, particularly at the onset, and I would say that for days, if not weeks, after the onset, there was a just kind of almost a lightness in the body, and a lot more, not really energy, but just kind of more physical acuteness, if that makes sense. Like my reflexes seem heightened, and there was a lot of there was a lot going on physically. I mean, to use the chakra center kind of lens, I suppose, there was activity in each of those areas that didn't seem to be going on previously. But certainly the way that it started was really with the feeling of energy rising and going out through the crown of the
Okay, and how long did that last?
head. Probably 10 or 15 minutes. In a really noticeable way, where I wasn't really able to do a whole lot, and I actually started crying at the time that that happened.
Right, and this is while listening to GOT soundtrack.
Is.
Yeah, and that's all you were doing, was just chilling out and listening to the music.
Yeah, I think I'd just gotten out of the shower, dried off, and sat down for a minute. Maybe I was, starting to drink a glass of water or something like that. Really normal kind of time.
And no intoxicants.
Well, at the time I was using a lot of prescribed stimulants, and I'm not sure if I'd taken one that day or not, but I was definitely very immersed in using those at the time, which was not a healthy thing for me.
What kind?
Adderall and Vyvanse, and occasionally another one that's a different class of stimulant called modafinil.
And did you look for or find any correlation between those chemicals and the experience that you had?
Yes, in the well, if you manic episode's a really broad term, but if you include manic episode in the experience, if you include that kind of label in the experience, then definitely. But I didn't find much. I will say, so there's a supplement that I was taking at the time, and its main purpose is to boost testosterone. It's not a steroid, but it also has some neurological effects. And when I looked at the receptors that that substance hits, which are called the N-methyl D-aspartate receptors, I found some papers. I found like some scientific papers on Kundalini rising experiences that implicated those receptors. And I really find that pretty reductionist now, but I don't think it's wrong to bring it up. I think it might be a piece of the puzzle. You know, we do have these proteins in our brain and nervous system that have effects. And when we take drugs, they obviously interact with those facets of our body.
And why were you taking something to increase your testosterone?
Well, as I mentioned in the email, there was, at the time, I had this attitude of kind of like power seeking and sort of a self-commodification attitude. And I thought that, you know, more alertness, more wakefulness during the day, and more testosterone equals more drive. And, you know, I thought at the time I could make more money and do better work. And, you know, kind of, it's sort of like a self, I mean, I would not consider it this now, but at the time I thought of it as a self-optimization type of perspective. And a lot of the clients that I was working with had similar attitudes. So I'd been in that headspace for about 2 or 3 years at that time.
So you knew other people who were taking testosterone?
Oh, definitely. You know, I worked with, and sometimes I still do, although I do it from more of a harm reduction standpoint now, and I personally stay away from all that now. But at the time, I was definitely working with a lot of people, athletes and bodybuilders, who would take steroids. And not that I, you know, I wasn't just enabling them, but it was definitely a culture that I was pretty immersed in.
But separate from, I mean, in your case, separate from bodybuilding or trying to physically alter yourself.
Yes, some of my motivation for boosting testosterone had nothing really to do with bodybuilding. It was more for the psychological benefit.
Did you experience it as a high?
Definitely, yeah. It's actually a much more physical high than most psychoactive drugs, but it can definitely be experienced as a high. And, you know, it does tie into, like, it can tie into self-image. In a way that most drugs can't. So because there is that physical manifestation, and I use the term in the notes of, you know, people seeking embodiment will be drawn to, you know, people seeking a sensation of being embodied and being solidly in their body, I think will be drawn to things like bodybuilding and steroid use. And I'm not so sure that it actually helps. I think it's kind of a band-aid, but yeah, all those things can be pretty seductive for certain people.
Mm-hmm. Did you listen to my conversation with Martin about David Sharner and stuff?
I think I listened to about half of it so far.
So do you remember me talking about the cowboy and the fool?
No.
Yeah. Well, the cowboy, there are two modes of awareness that I dreamt about a long time ago and never really forgot, because it helped me. It gave me a sort of model, a simple symbolic model for understanding consciousness, not entirely obviously, but, you know, a better understanding of consciousness in the different modes. And my dream self, or my unconscious, came up with the terms the cowboy and the fool. And the cowboy is the focused awareness, where we're like the cowboy, we're looking, it's predatorial, perhaps you could say, we're always like, it's like that saying, to the hammer everything is a nail, to a cowboy everything is a target. So we're always ready to draw our gun and aim and shoot, and just going through life looking for things to shoot. And the fool mode is the unfocused awareness, which is the opposite mode. And that's a little bit how you're describing yourself. You're saying it would be non-functional to just be gazing at objects and in kind of wonder, except that I'd say you mixed up a bit of cowboy in there, because you were imagining asking yourself questions like, how did that vase get there, or why is it that color? That I would say, sort of intuitively, that would be the cowboy trying to take over the fool mode, or not being comfortable in totally unfocused awareness, and so trying to somehow focus it, but it's kind of impossible, because as you are aware, you can't function at that level, and because you couldn't answer, or there'd be no end to those questions. So the state of unfocused awareness is just being fully receptive, just perceiving, you know, receiving the perceptual data without trying to filter it or organize it. And the cowboy mode, you could also say left brain, right brain, is what organizes and sifts through and then sorts out. In the Jordan Peterson model, it sorts out the obstacles from the tools and then throws out everything else, right? What can I use? What have I got to get around or over? What's irrelevant? That's what the focused awareness is for. Anyway, so that's what testosterone sounded like. The way you described it, it sounds like wanting to amp the cowboy mode to always be in that focused, directed awareness.
Oh yeah, you're spot on, absolutely. And I think that in case it wasn't clear, I think that the kind of hyper ambition is really one of the things that poisoned the whole. Yeah, because I realized something unusual is happening to me, and I thought at the time maybe I can harness this to do what I was doing before in a better way. And I kind of think that's bullshit now. I just think it's just really trying too hard and you know, trying to be something that I'm not. But it really did some harm to me, because I was in this, I'm not going to say good, but very interesting state of consciousness. And I had this pattern from before where I was trying to, you know, do things and be ambitious. And I think that's really where I went wrong, or made it more unsafe and unpleasant. But something else, when you said cowboy, something else that I put in the notes there at the end of 2014, where I briefly said something about having a fully formed alter persona emerge, that was actually a cowboy persona.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd never had an interest in Westerns or cowboy culture or anything like that.
Huh. So how did it manifest then?
Well, so when I went to the mental hospital and got out, and I mentioned feeling, in the notes, I mentioned feeling estranged from my family and angry because they had advised going to the mental hospital, and it turned out to be really traumatic. And one of your guests actually has gone into some detail about that, which I totally agree with. There, you know, it's a really terrible place to be, I think, especially if you're not at your best, you know. So anyway, I was angry when I got out, and I was considering, thankfully I didn't, but I was considering just totally starting over and kind of disappearing and emerging in some new area and just not continuing relations with my family or my girlfriend at the time. And so as I thought this over and decided what to do, I wanted to spend some time in the woods. And my family has some property where I can go out on, essentially just some wilderness. There's like, you know, a few dozen acres that back up against thousands of acres. And it's probably been 50 or 100 years since it was logged. And so it's pretty wild. And so the way that it manifested was I was camping out and spending time by myself. And I had to buy a few things. None of this was decided on a conscious level, like, oh, I think it'd be a good idea to buy this hat and this clothing. My voice even changed. Like I talked with a weird accent. It lasted almost maybe a month or a month and a half, no more than that, almost exactly a month, maybe a month and a half at most. And, of course it just made my family think like, oh, now he's just completely descending into full blown mental illness. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, my, my, my kind of rational explanation for what was going on was just that it was a way of asserting an identity, because my identity from before had been totally shattered by the trauma of being in that institution for about a week. And, you know, during the time that it seemed like a good idea to start over and part ways with the people that I felt like I couldn't trust anymore at the time, it seemed like, well, you know, I'll just go with this kind of ready-made identity. You know, it's a strongly culturally ingrained idea, so it's just this archetype that's readily available. But, you know, the more that I think about it, the kind of, from the trauma standpoint, I think that, you know, alters are a real thing. Not that my main persona was totally disassociated. Like, I have memory of the time, but it all seems very interesting now from a trauma lens, how automatic it was and how little control I really had over what I was doing at the time.
Tell me, people, what drives a woman to drive for hours? Meet a funny-looking man in the bar of the Plains Hotel. Company him upstairs. Answer several prayers. And drive right back without so much as a fare-thee-well. Well, she's an educated girl, so she knows how to be ironic. Deflect or talk a feeling with finesse. What was she trying to get? What did she get instead? She ain't talking, so it's anybody's guess. You say that you hate that prairie wind. Nevertheless, you do a very fine imitation of it. Was it the same thing to you, to me? Blew you away from me again. Say that you hate that prairie wind. I asked her about the ring upon her finger. When we first touched hands, we sat in the hotel chair. For a moment she dropped the mask, said someone loved me in the past. I neglected to ask the question hanging there. Say that you hate that prairie wind. Nevertheless, you do a very fine imitation of it. Was it the same thing drew you to me, blew you away from me again? Say that you hate that prairie. Seduces you outside to take a stroll. Oh, it's exhilarating and bright till that cold wind comes up to bite you and remind you of all the things you can't control. You say that you hate that prairie wind. Never nevertheless, you do a damn fine imitation of it. Was it the same thing to you, to me? Blew you away from me again. Say that you hate that pretty wind. You're so pretty when you say you hate that pretty wind. So pretty when you ride. So pretty when you ride up. I'll be in Berlin in October.
I don't think that alters manifest generally in the way that we think they do if we've read MKUltra or watched movies like Dressed to Kill or what have you, where the very extreme cases of split personality where there's no real dialogue between the different personalities and there's just amnesia, you know, total amnesia barriers and so on and so forth. I'm sure that does exist, but if it's a spectrum, and I think it is, then that's, you know, one end of the spectrum, and the other end of the spectrum is just, you know, everybody who has moods, and they sometimes don't recognize themselves and they act in ways that are weird. And then somewhere a little further along the spectrum is what you're describing, where you semi-consciously want to reinvent yourself and cut off relationships and so on, and to do so you end up semi-consciously creating an altar, but, you know, without any amnesia to speak of. And I can certainly relate to that. I mean, it's making me think back on, well, my life really, but a specific time when I very consciously started to dress like Indiana Jones. you know, just because I liked that look, and I liked to sort of change my looks, and I was already, whatever, you know, kind of halfway there when I noticed it, and I thought, oh, let's go the whole way. I'll, you know, find the hat, and I went as far as not the whip. I didn't get the whip, and I imagine you didn't get the gun, right? But I went far enough that a couple of people noticed. Probably a couple of people made a joke about Indiana Jones. This was in Mexico. It was a very short phase, and unlike what you're describing, I don't think it was necessarily triggered by anything. But it's just occurred to me, I mean, that throughout my life I've not only changed, you know, taken on different names, moved to different countries, including most extreme cases with Morocco, cutting off all ties with family. But I also adopted very drastically different wardrobes. I mean, really drastic, actually, almost the whole spectrum. I've never worn a top hat, but I certainly dressed to the extent that I was seen as a dandy, like my brother, not to the same extent, but definitely I was called a dandy with the scarves and the big coats and the hats and stuff. And to the other end, you know, like a shaggy sheep wool poncho and beard, and basically looking like a very stylish homeless person. So, and all the phases in between. And I hadn't really thought about it in terms that you just described your experience, that I was basically trying to alter my persona and thereby unconsciously coming up with alters.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the degree of dissociation or pain that you're in prior to that would be like a good way to analyze what was really going on, because I know that for me it was really just about escaping from these really, you know, at the time seemed tragic to me circumstances. And so it's like the precursor to that is after I recovered from that, you know, pretty strange behavior that was kind of not consciously chosen. It was about facing what was going on before that. So I guess we just picked, you'd said Indiana Jones. So I guess we picked some kind of, you know, heroic protagonist to try to Well, in your case, you said it wasn't really because of trauma, but
Well, I'm sure it was because everything, I see everything, all my behavior until recently in the context of trauma now, as you may have noticed. But I mean, specifically that time, I don't recall it being after any, like in your case. But I think it was just an ongoing thing, like I was just constantly having to reinvent myself, just as I was constantly having to move from one place to the next because of the trauma, the feeling that I was being hunted by something dangerous, which fits, of course, that I or you would want to identify with not just heroic figures, but a specific kind of masculine heroic figure. I guess they generally are this kind, but obviously that have weapons, you know, that can fight, can deal with danger. But also, I mean, both the cowboy and Indiana Jones, they're explorers of the unknown. I mean, a cowboy's like the frontiersman, you know? And Indiana Jones, yeah, he goes into the jungle and the unknown to find these artifacts. So actually quite a fitting persona or a symbolic archetypal persona when you're being overwhelmed by the contents of the unconscious. And you literally went into the wilderness. Right? So it's a way to enact that, to externalize the unconscious and the threatening, you know, unknown within you.
Absolutely, yes.
And it occurs to me, I mean, I want to go back to the Kundalini thing, but it occurred to me, I'll say it now so I don't forget, it may be a premature leap, but that you were taking all this testosterone that, as you said, was intensifying your focus and your ambition, so, you know, making the cowboy mode stronger. And that somehow possibly led to the Kundalini experience. I mean, it did, sequentially it led to it, whether there was any causal factors there. And the Kundalini experience was, which I say I want to hear more about, but what you have said about it, it did sound like being overwhelmed by contents of the unconscious in some way and going into unfocused awareness. So it's almost as though there was a compensatory reaction on the part of your unconscious to the attempt to narrow down your identity, like that. Sort of drove you into a corner, and then there was a, like, the dam burst or something.
What I would say when you said identity, I thought of the mental hospital, because that's a place where I don't think you can really go there. And again, it was only like 5 to 7 days that I was in there, but it's really hard to retain your sense of self or your identity, because you know, you're essentially under a microscope, and not everyone there is very well trained. You know, I've got a bit of formal education in psychology, and you know, that not everything is by the book, and they're going a lot off of unfounded assumptions. And this has been written about a lot. There's a book called Asylums, and there's a lot of pretty good info that people could look for about how mental institutions really. There's a very, well, my experience, which I have heard from other people too, is that it was very patronizing and, you know, not really about recovery, but more about, like, sort of scrutinizing the behavior of people there, maybe for the purposes of keeping them there longer. Like, it's very hard, I think, once you get in that system to be seen as really as a full person. I think it's really easy to get sucked into that system. And so there's almost a feeling of danger when you're there, or at least for me and for some other people that I've talked to or heard about, that anything that you say is going to be turned into some grounds to keep you there longer. And, you know, you can see some people that are very institutionalized who are there, and they really just don't, they don't talk a lot. And, you know, a big thing is that I think almost anybody that ends up in one of those is going to have medications pushed on them, which is a pretty alarming thing to have, because, you know, whether you know what the meds do or not, they're generally very high doses. And again, just for the purposes of the ends of the mental institution, not so much for the recovery or well-being of the patient. And so that, you know, with that trauma and then coming out of that, my identity was totally smashed, because it's like a week of really just kind of breaking down usual social interactions and It was really disconcerting. I'm not sure where I was going with that, but
How long after the Kundalini rising experience was did you commit yourself?
Say about 3 weeks.
Oh, okay, so it's a very short time period then. Yeah, because I was going to say, again, you know, I'm reluctant to be joining dots so quickly, but we don't have that much time today, so that there is also almost possibly like a mirror image of what I was speculating about with the testosterone, hyper-focused awareness, cowboy identity, leading to the Kundalini experience of the awakening, and then that got too much, and then the institution made it even worse. Made it worse. As you said, you were really losing a sense of your identity, and then when you came out, you ended up going off into the wilderness and going into this cowboy mode. You summoned the cowboy altar. So it's almost like a bookended thing there. You see, at least in my model, if you don't mind me sort of testing it out here, that you were
highly
in focused awareness. Something broke through, and you went really into unfocused awareness. You thought that maybe committing yourself would actually help put yourself back together, but it had the opposite effect, right?
Yes, that's all accurate.
And then, so then you got the hell out of there, and then you went the opposite direction from an institution to the wilderness, which they're very much like opposites, no? Like, what's the opposite of the wilderness? Over-socialized environment, an institution, and you even use the term institutionalized. And so then you put yourself in the wilderness so you could be wildernessified, and that sort of gave birth to this cowboy altar, which is, you know, an appropriate altar for surviving in the wilderness. So yeah, there seems to be a lot of archetypal meaning there. It's quite rich, I'd say. And what strikes me as well is that it's sort of counterintuitive, because one might think, as you did, that if you need to get sane, well, put yourself in an institution. I mean, it's not something I would ever think, but you could see how that is a sort of extremification of a certain kind of reasoning that we have as socialized beings, which is that sanity, identity, groundedness, functionality, all these things are to do with society. And therefore, you know, if we put ourselves in the hands of society, so to speak, if we immerse ourselves in society, it will make us sane. Of course, the opposite's really the case. Society makes us insane. And if you take it all the way to the extreme, go somewhere where it's actually an institution created supposedly to make people sane, you will really find out how fucked up society is. So then the flip side of that is to discover your identity. You don't want to be surrounded by people reinforcing your identity. You want to be in the wilderness where nothing is telling you who you are. And then something, your unconscious will give birth to something. In your case, this temporary character, the cowboy. Interesting, a character in the David Lynch thing, Mulholland Drive, there's the cowboy in that, which is all about this kind of dream, you know, the dream realms and stuff. So yeah, there's quite a lot there. Anyway, so I was just riffing a bit.
That was great. That character in that movie definitely has a very archetypal dreamlike feel, and that's kind of the feel that I had when I was in that state. So another good connection.
So how long did your cowboy last then?
I'd say about 4 to 6 weeks, and I don't remember exactly what the transition out of it was, what precipitated it, if anything, but there was a definite endpoint. Actually, I would say probably what sort of seemed to end that phase was when I started back smoking pot, which at the time seemed like a good way to deal with the trauma. But it was about maybe 6 weeks at most.
Mm. So going back to Kundalini rising then, because I didn't get to a question I wanted to ask, which was, What was going on with your identity or your sense of yourself during that initial period where you're feeling the energy and you were looking at the world in new ways, how were you seeing yourself?
There was a huge sense of expansion, and I think that if I, at the time, that if I'd had a more of a grounding in certain philosophy about levels of identity and identity constructs, then I could have handled it in a healthier way. But I think my own kind of egoic reaction to that was to double down on the egoic activities, and that was definitely in conflict with the experience that I was having. But it's hard. It's how it went, and so now I'm trying to analyze it in hindsight, and I'm not sure what was driving what. So it seems that the sense of expanding self and expanding definitions of self was inherent to the experience, and then the unhealthy mindset that I brought to the experience is what sort of bound me to that, you know, egoic actions, like you know, just like thinking how can I increase my power and standing based on this change in consciousness, really is where I went with it.
Right, okay. And how quickly did you go to that?
Within a few days. I mean, it was really, my ritual really at the time was to wake up and get to work pretty early, and I'd be doing a lot of phone calls with people, consultations, not really life coaching, but just really like remote personal training, and I was getting paid pretty well for it. I would do that for just hours and hours each day. It was really intense and sort of draining, so that's why I was taking those stimulants, and so I stuck with that routine, and
so you didn't change your routine after the experience.
Well, I didn't immediately change my routine, but I think my routine led me to thinking like, how can I do this but on a bigger scale? So I was thinking like, oh, maybe I can consult with it seems a little bit silly in hindsight now, but at the time I was really thinking maybe I can consult with the executives and show them new perspectives and, you know, make a whole lot of money on consulting fees that way. And it's not even that I was really, really fixated on material things. I wanted success, and I wanted, power is how I look at it now. I wouldn't have said at the time that I wanted power, but I think that's really what was driving me in hindsight.
What would you have said at the time then?
Probably some sort of neoliberal platitude, like, this is the best way to make a difference in the world by, reaching my full potential or something like that.
Because I think you said in your notes that you were ensconced in the neoliberal mindset during this period.
Yeah. Yeah, totally unquestioningly. It wasn't like I picked it off a menu as the best worldview, but I just drifted into that.
Right. So I still don't feel like I've got a visceral sense of what you're experiencing in yourself in the 15 minutes or so while the shift happened. Like, how were you, what was happening to your sense of identity during those moments, would you say?
Well, I had a lot of, I had a lot of, there was almost like a, what is the word that people use, like during a near-death experience, almost like a life review type of experience, where I was thinking about a lot of memories that I hadn't thought about for a long time. Thinking is not quite the right word, but I was consciously experiencing a lot of what felt like stored memories, and feeling it was like I had a different perspective on them, and that definitely added to the sense of expanding identity. So my memory seemed to become more acute, my recall seemed to become more acute, and it was definitely very visionary. So in that way, it kind of reminded me, it wasn't that much subjectively like a psychedelic experience, but in the sense of it being very visionary and lots of thoughts flooding in and lots of, I used the term download earlier. So there was the bodily aspect, which was the rising energy. There was the emotional aspect, which was just this overwhelming sense of really experiencing multiple emotions at once, very physically. And then there was the visionary and almost life review type of aspect.
And were you, I mean, you said that you had a very reductionist and scientific mindset at that point, so were you were unfamiliar with spiritual doctrines about how the self is unreal and things like that. I mean, I guess that's more Buddhist, particularly Buddhist, but that kind of concept of the self being an illusory thing, was that something you were at all familiar with?
I was like 10% familiar with it. I had so I later read the full book, but I'd heard like a couple interviews by Sam Harris on this book that he has called Waking Up, which I actually think is a pretty good like it's basically like a primer on the type of spirituality and philosophy that you just mentioned for people with an atheist materialist worldview. And you know, within that somewhat limited purview, I actually think it's a pretty good book, but I hadn't read that book at the time. But I had actually, you know, been exposed to some thinking that the self is not real, but it wasn't deeply embedded to the, you know, to the point where I had it accessible at the time of that experience or made that connection immediately, unfortunately.
Oh, fortunately, I don't know. I mean, I just brought it
sure.
up. It wasn't exactly random, but it was because the reason I was asking about your Kundalini rising and your experience of yourself was because I was curious to see how much it correlated with, if at all, with Dave O'Shaughnessy's description of his enlightenment, but also my own experiences of premature enlightenment, which did seem to also center around an experience of myself as illusory and unreal. And actually, I mean, I've had that sense throughout my whole life and as far back as I can remember as a child. So it's certainly been consistent throughout my life, spiritual seeking or otherwise. And because you described it almost in the opposite terms, where you describe an expanded sense of self, which could encompass a view of the previous self being unreal, but you didn't include that in. It sounded more as though the self that you're accustomed to considering yourself was getting turbo boosted by the Kundalini. That's what it sounded like, and also, or at least that's what you wanted anyway to happen, but also seemed like it to some extent was already happening.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I think it's I've described it maybe one or two times in the past as being almost like just being supercharged, but it was still very jarring. I mean, if I hadn't been clinging so hard to that identity, I think that it might have been different. But yeah, I can't say that it was like a classical experience of finding that the self is false or anything. That's not how I experienced it at the time.
So when you say clinging so hard to your identity, I mean, what do you mean by that? Was it under threat during this? I know it was later, but during the first period, did you feel like your conditioned self was under threat in some way?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it, because it felt like what I was experiencing was so disorienting that I had this knee-jerk reaction to, you know, well, how can I make use of this? And a lot of other I statements, like, you know, asking questions from the perspective of the ego and trying to use it to improve my life and that kind of thing, instead of just being in the experience. So there was definitely a lot of, and I mean, you know, at the time I was very, like I alluded to before, I spent a lot of my days at that time using, you know, using my constructed self to advise other people and to experience the world in that way. So it was just kind of a habitual reaction to life. And it's the way that I responded to this experience as well.
Did anyone else notice a change in you besides the fact you were telling them? I mean,
I don't think so. Other than, after a certain point, I realized it was probably not good to, you know, I realized, well, okay, no one else really necessarily cares too much about this. And so I think I only told the one person at that moment that it happened.
So in your notes, you describe this period and the periods after, I mean, bringing it all the way up to date pretty much, and what you, one of the things you describe is your changing worldview. You don't talk much about your worldview before the experience, but you've referred to it here as this neoliberal scientific reductionist thing. So not a million miles away from Sam Harris, in fact, only without, maybe without the high status charismatic celebrity sheen to it, but anyway, you know, a fairly respectable and you know, sort of socially validated mindset, let's say, that you had adopted unconsciously at the point that you had this breakthrough event, if it was that, certainly this destabilizing event, and then the period after, which has eventually led you to me, was one of I guess expanding your worldview to incorporate all kinds of perspectives and descriptions of the world that previously you had either were unaware of or had rejected out of hand. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Right. And that included psychedelics, marijuana, as you've already been smoking beforehand?
Well, I used marijuana heavily from about 16 to 21, and this experience occurred when I was 27 or 28, or 16 to 20, and then took about a 7-year break or so, and then so I started it back after, after the experience and after the institutionalization, or after the check into the institution.
Right, that's interesting, and that was because you thought it would be therapeutic. And psychedelics, was that a new thing that you were experimenting with at that point? Or?
So I probably had used mushrooms about 3 to 5 times in my teens, and stopped those around the same time that I stopped smoking pot the first time. And so, I was really just kind of persuaded by all the hype around using psychedelics and microdosing them to deal with trauma and to deal with other conditions, you know.
Okay, that's interesting too, that there's that much hype about. So you weren't using them to try and regain your Kundalini rising experience?
No, definitely not. I was somewhat wary of that happening, and I'm actually surprised that I did them at all, but that's probably just, you know, looking back now, seems like it was a little bit foolhardy. But no, I wasn't, I didn't think that regaining it would be the way to go, but I did get a little bit of I was meditating a lot, and at this point I was immersed in a lot of philosophy around the falseness of the self. So I got pretty caught up in that idea that it would be good to, you know, if not eliminate, then reduce the ego and that sort of thing.
And this was related to taking psychedelics?
Yes. The sort of 2015. So if we talk about 2014 is when the Kundalini experience happened, and when the trauma happened, the biggest traumatic events happened in that year. In 2015 and 2016, when I was using psychedelics pretty heavily and microdosing a lot, that was with a goal of reaching higher states of consciousness, hopefully permanently. That's how I looked at it at the time.
But also of healing your trauma.
Yes.
And the books you were reading, did they intersected with occultism, or the occult phase was separate and came later?
They minimally, I wouldn't say they heavily intersected with occultism. Maybe like a little bit of esoteric material, like you'll come across in some texts about Buddhism and Eastern philosophy, but they weren't expressly occult. And I mostly got interested in occultism through some podcasts and websites. And at this point, I'd also been just more as a hobby, interested in learning about conspiracies and parapolitics. And, I enjoyed the kind of agnostic perspective that you have to have on that to get deep into it. And, so it all kind of ran together, but really the consciousness perspectives that I had initially were not occult based. And, I didn't take the occult stuff very seriously until I had some weird experiences around it. And then I just sort of, for the most part, backed off it.
But you were practicing it, I think you said, for a while.
Yes, it overlapped with the psychedelic exploration.
So you were practicing it, but you weren't taking it that seriously.
Not too seriously. It's not that I thought it was a waste of time or anything like that. I just thought, well, not too much can go wrong here, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Right. Seriously enough to experiment with, but not seriously enough to be wary of it. Yeah, that's the perfect snare, isn't it? So where did Robert Anton Wilson come in? At what point was he influential?
Well, he wasn't hugely influential, but I had to go back to him as both an interesting person in the 20th century history of the occult, and also the conspiracy theorist sort of mindset that a lot of it kind of traces. I know that's a loaded term, but yeah, a lot of that traces back to some of his writing as well.
And you started reading him around the psychedelic period.
Yes, but I haven't read him heavily. I haven't read all of his popular books or anything like that.
So, I mean, how steep would you say the curve is in terms of information or quasi-information? Like, how would you have regarded somebody with the perspectives that you have now, like 4 years ago, prior to the Kundalini Rising event? Would you have seen yourself as a kook or a sucker or what?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I just never heard anyone at the time. You asked about sort of 4 years ago. I might have assumed that the person was the future me or someone with similar views was had valid experiences that they were misinterpreting. I was pretty open-minded at the time, but I hadn't been exposed to very many people who could articulate a lot of this stuff very well from a proponent standpoint. I would say, I mentioned Gordon White in the notes. I think that he is a really good example of someone who I don't want to speak for him, but I would say he's definitely a proponent of a lot of this stuff, definitely the occult. And, rhetorically, he's really good, and I mean, I could find some areas to differ with him now for sure. But if I'd stumbled across someone like him sooner, I would have been really interested in what he had to say. But I just never had. So I guess it depends on the context where I encountered these views. There's a lot of very shrill and sort of people out there that don't present it in a very compelling way, which is why I'd never really been too open to it.
Right. And you said you came across me about 3 years ago.
Yeah, I think it may have been on Chris Knoll's blog. You'd had an exchange with him and sent him a picture that he didn't care for, which I thought was a little bit, I didn't really understand what he was getting at there. But yeah, that's the first time that I saw your name.
Oh. Was that only 3 years ago? No, that would have been longer, because that was sort of Crucial Fiction's time. That was when Crucial Fiction's site went up, which was 5 years ago.
Yeah, I dig through a lot of archives and things. I'm not always as current.
Okay. All right. Interesting. So that led you to, what was your first exposure to me after that?
Probably on Disinfo.
Right, series of things about Street of Prisoner Infinity stuff and occult Yorkshire stuff.
Right. And also, I remember too when I saw your article on CERN, which I really think was excellent, it articulated a lot of things. I had been looking for someone to talk to about that. You know, I would show that video to some friends and I would expect them to say, you know, that's weird that that even exists, even if it's not real, that kind of thing. And no one really seemed to think much of it. And so when I found your article on the, you know, CERN supposed human sacrifice hoax, I say supposed hoax or however you want to look at it.
Whatever, the PSYOP, let's call it a PSYOP one way or another, even if it was a student PSYOP.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really resonated with me. So, it definitely, you know, your perspective on the second matrix or your statements on the second matrix are really resonant with me. And so I wouldn't say I got fully enmeshed in the second matrix, but I had to see that it was there to appreciate the subtleties of your positions on things. And that's when I started really binging on your podcast, especially.
Mm-hmm. When you say binging, it conjures images of you lying around with, you know, toe jam between your toes and devouring ice cream for 24-hour periods.
This podcast sounds like triple speed for a guy.
The end of the first part, and the second part will be up next Wednesday at horticulture.com/limitless. Thanks to those who've continued to donate and support this podcast, appreciate it very much. Also, I'd like to mention here that I'm offering one-to-ones liminal life coach consultations. You can find the details, what they are, at the website. And contact me directly, jason@protonmail.com, if you're interested. This is The Limitless, the podcast between. Thanks for listening.